Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
This episode of EU Startups Podcast is brought to you by Vonta. Whether you're starting or scaling your company's security program, demonstrating top-notch security practices and establishing trust is more important than ever. Vonta automates compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more, saving you time and money while helping you build customer trust. Plus, you can streamline security reviews by automating questionnaires and demonstrating your security posture with a customer-facing trust center, all powered by Vonta AI. Over 7,000 global companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora use Vonta to manage risk and prove security in real time. Get a special offer of $1,000 off at vonta.com/EU Startups. That's vanta.com/EU Startups.
Hey everyone, this is Marcin Lewandowski and you're listening to the EU Startups Podcast. My guest today is Thomas Ribaud, co-founder and CEO of Miro. With over 300 million euros fundraised in 2020, Miro has reached unicorn status in less than 3 years and become the worldwide leader in AI-powered photography. Now, with Blast Angels, Thomas is building startup investment clubs around the world, empowering one and each of everyone with the opportunity to invest in tomorrow's tech startups. Thomas, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to have you. So actually, growing up in the artistic heart of Paris, being surrounded by the city's vibrant culture and its creative energy, how did it all start for you, and what's Miro all about?
Oh, it's a long time ago now. I'm getting older. It was 2016, so it's 8 years ago. Honestly, I think the best projects, actually best things in life, and they happen randomly. So it happened randomly. I just met a photographer. It's just true. You meet someone randomly because you go right on the street and you sometimes start a project or pivot on a project because you see something on TV or, that's what happened. I met someone called Guillaume. He was a photographer. He was starting to do something called Miro at the time, where he was like, there is something to do in the photography industry. It's not processed. They don't use AI at all and stuff like that. And I just, talked to him. And I was reading, I had a company already, but it continued for a few years at the same time. It was a consulting company, quite classic shit. And I quickly shifted to, at the same time to Miro, because the idea looked so great. It was the time of the marketplaces. It's a bit different now. But you had so many different marketplaces, Fiverr and stuff like that. And I was like, there's nothing happening in the photography industry. Photography, quite arts overall. I was trying to go into many different directions. And so I went in.
Sounds good. So Miro's growth is legendary. What were the, what were the craziest moments during the hypergrowth phase?
Well, what happened that was really cool, let's say, is that we did it all before everyone was fundraising big time stuff, in 21, 2022, basically, we're kind of a bubble at some point in the tech. So it was prior to that. So it was kind of in Europe, one of the, I think it was the first or the second biggest fundraising at the time. And in less than 3 years, in 3 years. And so that was quite insane in terms of indeed growth mentality inside the mindset, inside the company. And so that's quite a cool journey, to be frank. Unfortunately, COVID hit 6 months afterwards. So we need to change a few stuff. But I would say between 2018 and 2019, where you go from around 100 employees to 1,000. Mm-hmm. In 10 months and you fundraise 2 times and big amounts and blah, blah, blah. It's kind of crazy, Crazy. I was looking at, it's very different, but you I don't know if you've seen the series We Crashed.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Which I do recommend. It's a very cool series, even if it doesn't end very well. It really looked like this a little bit in terms of craziness inside the company.
Man. Yeah, that's...
So it was really cool. It was really cool.
Nice, that's an amazing experience to have. Thomas, so actually expanding to over 100 countries within this time sounds wild. What were the most unexpected challenges you faced, and how did you keep things running smoothly?
Well, I named it COVID.
Yeah.
But you need to understand this was a marketplace where you need to send people on the street to photograph buildings and food and lifestyle, e-commerce, whatever stuff. Right? You need to send people. And in one day, it all got shut down.
Yeah.
Basically. But even worse than that, in terms of surprises that you were mentioning, is that when we reopened, for example, France, I don't know if Poland was reopened, no idea. Then it got closed again and then opened again. And then, you know, India, for example, that's a country you love.
Yeah.
India got closed and reopened, I don't know how many times. You have no notice from anyone, like it closes like in one day. And so you stop, you restart, you stop, you restart, you stop. You can't let go people, employees, because it's going to start again. No. And when you said we're in over 100 countries, which is true, the 111 actually, 111, quite easy to remember. But it was like Pakistan, Vietnam, Chile, and stuff like that. And so it was like on and off for like 18 months. It was tough shit. Like literally the business went down to almost close to €0 per month.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not like you're decreasing or, you know, the growth is reverted. It's like there's no revenue at all, you know. And then you need to build again and stuff like that. So that was a bit challenging. I would say the most challenging part was to not know what was ahead.
Yeah.
Because you do not know how to manage people, what to tell them. If you need to lay off 50%, 10%, 2%, 80%, you have no clue. Mm. So you do it in one time, then second time, then third time, because you have no clue if Vietnam is going to be closed again in 8 months. Mm-hmm. And we were all very optimistic, I think, at the time. Like first 1 week before COVID, we would be like, there's no way they close us down. Like, no way, you know.
Yeah.
And then it happened. And then we were like, come on, it's going to last 1 month and blah, blah, blah. And so I think we're all too much optimistic about it. And so in terms of management of the company, that's an issue. But again, went through it. It's life. Least to say that we're not the only one that went through that. But again, there's the shitty thing about it, like sometimes, is that you have some companies that were like making profited of it, from it, like a lot, specifically in the tech industry.
Yeah.
Right? Like a lot of the companies is like a boom. And for us, we're part of the 5 to 25% of the tech company that it was kind of a drama, you know? So it's frustrating, let's say. But, you know, again, everyone on earth went through it. So it's just like...
Yeah, but Thomas, actually managing, you know, like a team during such a rapid growth, generally must have been intense. And then you have this tough time. So what's your top tip for, you know, keeping the team morale at high? How do you manage people during such a tough times?
Well, first, for 1 month or two, the morale of the team was not so good. The reason I would say was that the I mean, close to me at least. The reason was that you go from quarterly board meetings to weekly board meetings, and you have so much new stuff to do just to report to the board and stuff like that, because everyone is very stressed and everything. So then you have your direction, your management that need to do slides and Excel files every 1 hour, every 2 hours. So the morale wasn't great. Now, honestly. Me, I was okay, and I think that the best way on the medium term to have everyone okay is to being okay yourself. The people in a company, they, I don't know how to say that precisely in English, but they suck on your energy when you're the CEO. Right, so if you are, they suck on your culture, on
they
the way
you
think,
you.
On your mindset, and so. They look up to you, it's true, but on top of looking up to you, for some reason, because it's very obvious when you go a bit out of it and you just look at it, they imitate stuff that you are and you do, you know, not because they look up to you necessarily, by the way, because I'm sure the people look down on you sometimes also or don't like you or whatever, you know,
I mean in a way that, you know, they see like how you behave in a tough, like there's a tough time, and then like you're the first person, like if you're feeling good, they feel more comfortable that okay, everything's gonna be all right.
Yeah, and even culturally speaking,
freak out. They're gonna be like, "Whoa!"
Oh, you can't freak out. Don't freak out. Yeah, for sure. But even, I mean, generally speaking, tough culture, you know, because basically having a good mood when you go through crisis, it's kind of a cultural thing, you know, being have a good mindset in the company, and it's the same for actually in every situation, every month of the year of the life. It's basically what the culture of the company, and really people really tend to imitate you. That's why we have different culture in different companies. Because you have different CEOs or different co-founders and all that. And so if yourself in times of crisis, you're like not exaggerating stuff and making a big thing out of nothing, or, you know, just thinking the world is ending, and you just like, just relax and like, anyway, can we do something about it? No. So let's wait and see. Then people just chill down for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. So I think I can give you 10 answers on how to answer your question and how to control this kind of stuff. The real answer is just be chill yourself. And I think everyone's happy.
I like it. I like your approach. Thomas, maybe let's talk about fundraising, and then we're going to smoothly kind of transition to the next thing that you're currently building. So, so raising, you know, like 300 million is probably no joke. What was your secret sauce for convincing investors to get on board?
Showing, even if you're not, but I was, but even if you're not, showing that you're sure of yourself, you know, in the way you speak. Like, not in the figures. You need to have good figures and stuff, obviously. Yeah? But showing that you seem, at least, to know your shit. Like, you okay. know what you're doing. In the behavior, in the way you talk, in the tone of the voice, you know, and stuff like that. You just know what you're doing. And so they start to trust you very quickly. After two meetings, you know, they start to trust you. Like, okay, this guy, when he's saying he's going to go from A to B or A to Z, it's not bullshit. Like, he seems to know what he's saying, you know?
Yeah.
And secondly, once you reach this point, which is quite quick, you need to build the FOMO. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fear of missing out, the fact that they don't want to be left out of a deal that's happening, you know? And that's the sales stuff, but you need to say no, you need to leave the room, you need to not accept stuff, you need to, you know what, it's not whatever, you need to say, guys, we don't want to get in, the other is saying yes, so I mean, I'm not going to go around it for 2 weeks, so just if you want to say yes, then you know, and that's it. You need to kind of be like this, because VCs, they are afraid to invest. I mean, you know, now I'm doing a lot of investments, as you know, so I see, exactly. I see what happens in the brain, but when I'm now on this side, I'm trying not to be like that, by the way, but VCs, they're afraid to invest. They're going to say, I need to put 50 fucking million in something. It's pure venture. They have no clue in reality what's going to happen in 3 years. Plus the partner, most of the time, does not dig into the figures. It's the analyst doing it. So, and they're doing money stuff. So they go back to it 1 week afterwards. They forget a bit. Blah, 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 and say, okay, I need to put 50 fucking million. And they don't want to do it, right? And they're afraid. And so if there is the neighbor, the other one, like Sequoia putting a bit of million, then they freak out. Then, okay, I need to focus. Do I need to get in? Sequoia is going in. And so basically, if they think that the other one is going in and the other one thinks that the other, they will all get in. Now, what happened that you can't, I mean, it's difficult to do that because obviously you can't say that the other one is going in if he's not going in. Or if he hasn't said that he's going in, right? So which word do you use to have them both think that they are... The two of them are going in, even if they have not said yes already. That's basically the game, right? So you don't say the name of the guy. You say it's a big one, but you can't say the name because you don't want them to talk to each other, which is true. By the way, it's true. And then, you know, it's honestly a poker game. It's a poker game. Like you need to show stuff, then you need to be careful because sometimes you need to go all in and you might lose. For the closing, for example, I left the room. And so because I was not accepting the conditions. Yeah, I was like not okay with a few stuff they were trying to push. And so I left the room and then they call me or they don't. And they call me back.
It's like a movie scene. Like a good
thing. Honestly, it's a poker stuff. It's a poker stuff. Poker, but when you, I will say my sales teams, when you, if you want to have a good negotiation, you need to be ready to lose, but like for real, not just for the bluff. You need to be ready to lose. Mm-hmm. And so when I left the room and a few times, even before the signatures time, on the phone and stuff like that, when I was saying no, I mean, I meant it. Yeah. Even if it could be a bluff, like I could actually say yes. Now that I say no, I was okay. If the guy said okay, too bad. Okay, too bad. And you need to, if you want to win a negotiation, you need to be okay to lose it. Voilà. And now when you have billions in mind and millions, it gets more stressful. But you need to be. So this is how you close a big round.
As you are,
and you need to be chill about it.
Exactly.
Well, you can't bluff if you're too much stressed. I mean, you go all in. If you play poker, I mean, there's two ways of paying poker. You can pay poker with 50 euros and you don't give a shit, and you need to pay poker put 10K, okay? When you put 10K, you really don't want to lose it, right? So the real poker is when you don't want to lose, the real one. So depending on the money you have, could be 100 euros, could be 1 million, I don't know, but like that's when you really don't want to lose, right? If you play the amount that is sufficient for you to be stressed and you go all in and it's a bluff, you can't be sweating. Like this doesn't work. So you need to be chill about it, and you need to agree and to know that you might lose it.
Awesome.
It's the same with fundraising. I mean, at least the fundraising that I made myself, because I was like, I raised too much, to be frank. Yeah. Like there is a fundraising that kind of makes sense because the figures are so nice and stuff. And so you fundraise 300 million, but I mean, that's what you're worth and it does make sense. So people just agree on the figures and they go in.
Okay.
Right. And there is a fundraising where you're supposed to raise, I don't know, 200 million and you fundraise 300 million.
Yeah.
And then it's about to be, you need to be good in terms of this. That was more on the first thing.
Love it. Venture Deals by Thomas Ribault, everyone. Now with Blast Angels, by the way, so first thing, like what's broken in, like you probably mentioned a lot of this stuff already, what's broken in the VC world that you're fixing with Blast Angels, and you know, what's like the thing or the coolest thing you're doing?
Why am I doing that? Basically, it's two things. The first, I've been asked from people I know or I don't thousands of times to follow me on investments I was doing myself into tech startup, right? From family, my banker, my doctor, guys online, Instagram, I don't know. And I was like, well, okay, maybe I can process that and help people follow me or follow others, basically, that are famous. But apart from that, the people don't put their money into what is called private equity. So basically into companies that are not listed publicly, CAC 40, NASDAQ. They don't do it, like 0%, 0.1%, right? And that's too bad because there's a huge amount of money sitting in the banks, right? And so what people do, they invest in real estate, basically. And that's it. And that's really a shame. And what I'm saying that, I've been saying that to my mother for 10 years. Huh? So I'm not just randomly giving advice. Because real estate is not so profitable, to be frank. You're going to have a 6 to 7% return on investment on a yearly basis, right? But you need to remove a lot of stuff that you're paying that sometimes is not included in that. It doesn't make so many profit to bring. And if you just open after this call, after this podcast, you open Google and you go on the most profitable asset class in the world over the next 20 years, it's startups. That's very easy. Like, and you can find it. There's many studies. I mean, from every stuff you want, from 80s to 90s to startups.
Yeah.
All right. So I was like, why the fuck don't people put their money into that? Right. Oh yeah. Yes, it's risky. Okay. But it's risky if you invest into one or two companies. If you invest into 10 or 20, it's risky like everything else. You have an average, some fail, others succeed. And because obviously with the figure I gave when I was saying it's the most profitable asset class, it's on average. So if you invest in 1K, 2K, 3K, 5K in 10 companies, then the risk is hedged. And so I was, wondering why. And so I Googled it like 18 months ago, and I go online and I find obviously something that I knew already, which is crowdfunding platform.
Yeah.
Right? Crowdcube in Europe, for example. 2DGo in France. AngelList, very famous in the US. And all these guys managed to kind of, in terms of PR, to create a name for themselves, right? So people a bit interested in this area, they're going to know Crowdcube, they're going to know business AngelList, right? But it doesn't work. You look at the figures, it's really limited. Mm-hmm. Like it's really this. First, in terms of business model, the revenue they're making is very low after 10, 15 years of existence. Then the EBITDA is super, super low because usually it's negative, right? After 10 to 15 years, right? So like, okay, it's not a very good business. But on top of that, the amount of money invested on a yearly basis is super low. It's getting better actually since last year, but it's still super low. I was like, why? And I think that's because two reasons. First, you do not have good founders that put their business plan and data online publicly. Yep. You don't want to do it. You don't want to do that. Nope. So you do it only if you have to, because you could not fundraise money on the side.
Yeah.
That's the first. That's it. And second, it's very, just very easy. And second, as a user, if you go online and you're not, you don't know so much about all of that, you arrive on this website, you have 20 listed companies, like different stuff all over the place, and you don't know what to do. It's like being on a restaurant and there's a menu is too big, you don't know what to order. Uh-huh. You know, and so you end up putting 100 euros or just not putting anything.
Yeah.
And that's it. And so it doesn't work. Right. So, and at the same time, I was like, okay, so it doesn't work. I was like, okay, but let's take Elon Musk. What if Elon Musk tweets and says, hey guy, I'm going to invest into a spaceship company. Who follows me? Who wants to go with me into this investment? And I'm like, the dude is going to fundraise 2 billion euros in a day, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what it means is that people are okay to invest money into companies that just need trust in between. Mm. And that's why I created Blast Angels, basically.
Nice. Sounds good. You got to tell me more about it when we meet in Barcelona.
Next week. Yes, sir.
Exactly. Actually, speaking of investing in startups, and you've made some investments already. Do you know how many investments you make so far?
So Blast Club in France, around 25-30. We opened Spain beginning of the year. So now it's 6 investments. We invest in Spain between 200k and 500k every 2 to 3 weeks, euros. In yeah. France now, the club invests between 2 and 5 million euros every 2 to 3 weeks. Now we're opening after summer Italy and the Nordics, plus probably end of year the UK, and we're trying to expand now to Brazil and Canada. So overall, if I piled up stuff, I don't know, I need to calculate, but let's say by in the next 18 months, hopefully a few hundred millions invested. But that's basically, now you're asking me maybe for me why I did that, by the way, because it would be for me too. Why the hell? I already made my money.
Yeah.
To be frank, I don't need to go again into the nightmare of creating a company, because that's quite a nightmare in terms of stress and workout. So what the fuck am I doing that? I was like everyone that made a cool company. Hey, let's go into investment. You know, it looks chill. You don't work so much, right? So let's fundraise a VC. Yeah. But I don't want to be investing 2 million a year, right? It doesn't make any sense. So I was like, okay, how do I invest amount that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So I was thinking about a 200 million euros fund, right?
Yeah.
It means that you need to invest in 5 years when you have a fund. So it means investing 40 million per year. You know? Like, well, okay. And then actually you understand that it's not possible to do that.
Yeah.
Because you're going to go, you're going to corporate enterprises and stuff like that. That's where you go to get money.
Yeah.
So you need to fundraise money before you invest it. Before you invest it. And actually it takes 15 years. Like you start with a very small fund of 20, 30 million. They trust you. They wait 3 years. Then you fundraise another one of 50 million. Reaching 200 million takes 10, 15 years if you're good. Uh-huh. And even with a good background stuff. And what I'm doing right now, in France, the club has invested already close to 100 million already. In 1 year, ish. So you need to multiply by five to compare it with the size of a fund. Right. Because again, they invest in 5 years. So it's like in France, it's a 500 million fund already. In Spain, it's going to be a 100 million fund by end of year. And it's going to be more by next year. And now we're opening other things. And basically I was trying, okay, can I build, as my thing was, can I build the biggest Series A, pre-Series A investment vehicle in the world in like 3 years, 4 years? And I think we're about to do it.
Yes, we can. Nice. Awesome. Hopefully. I love it. So now you're like playing, you know, you're playing poker with founders, not as a founder. You're on the other side of the table. Yeah. So actually, when you look at startups, when you look at founders, what are your absolute deal breakers?
Burn rate. First, there's two things. The personality, too much salesy, maybe too much like I was, I don't know, but too much salesy. Right, so you feel the bullshit. I'm like, dude, don't give me that food. I know it. So too much salesy, it's a bit of a pain, because then you know that what you're hearing is not 100%. You need to dig into it. It's a bit annoying. And then the burn rate. So burn rate is how much they lose in terms of cash every month. I'm trying to innovate in terms of investment thesis. I am not doing it operates like a VC, by the way. Because I haven't said the difference between that and crowdfunding platform. But we find a very famous guy locally, and we build trust around him, and we build an investment vehicle around the guy per country. But then we operate like a VC, so it's one deal by one deal. It's like a VC, but then people can get in, and then, so yeah, it's I'm meeting the both worlds. It's a really cool thing. The question again, sorry.
The question was about absolute deal breakers, and you were talking about the burn rate.
The
burn rate.
Yeah, the burn rate. And so sorry, it's lagging on me. I'm trying to have my own thesis. Usually VCs, what they do is that they spend and pray, would say, basically. So they're gonna they're going to invest the fund in, let's say, 10 companies. Mm-hmm. And in terms of profits, it's gonna do like zero for the first one, zero. For a second one, zero, 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 zero. Then number six is going to be like 0.8. Number seven, 1.2. Eight and nine, like, okay, no, two. And then the last one, hopefully, is going to be like 200.
Yeah.
That's the way they do it. Right? But it's super risky, and that's why you have up and down. You've seen what I've done, SoftBank, Tiger Capital. So like, it's super risky, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to do it differently. I'm trying to have no zero, maybe one zero. Let's say one zero-ish. Then 0.8, and then quickly 1.2, 2, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, basically. And so I'm investing into, and hopefully one that goes, beyond the web.
Yeah.
I'm trying to invest into companies that that software, AI, blockchain, stuff like that. But founders that do not burn the house every month to grow, that are a bit more smart in the way they do things. And so they're going to be like doing 20K, 50K, up to 200k per month, but they're burning 10k, 20k, 30k per month, and that's it, right?
Yeah.
And now they need 1-3 million to go a bit quicker for the next 12 months. But the whole company is not built on burn rates, which is what I did myself, by the way. So I'm not saying it's I did that. A lot of companies, Uber, Amazon, a lot of companies did that back in the days, but it's super risky. So I'm saying like the burn rate needs to grow progressively. You can burn 1 billion per month. You can do that if you're doing 10 billion a month or 5 billion a month, right? So you need to build to grow the burn rates that makes sense. I'm trying to do that. So it's a very different approach.
Sounds good. Sounds awesome, Thomas. Well, actually, so this is going to be the last question of this conversation, unfortunately. I love talking with you, and I could spend I think hours talking about it and listening to you.
But, not sure now.
Looking back, any moments you wish you could redo, or also what advice would you give to your younger self just starting out in tech?
It's a tough question, my friend. I don't know. I got so lucky on so many things, to be frank. That's difficult to be like, I would like to redo stuff. I failed my first company, so I lost 2 years, 40K that I didn't have. I had to take a credit to pay it, so I need to reimburse it. Then Miro, I almost bankrupted two times because the term sheet was not signed. So much risk. I had credit on my personal thing for Miro. So that, so much risk, maybe unnecessary. Failures, investment that didn't work out. I could give you 200 reasons why. 200 things I would do differently now that I know the outcomes, right? Yeah. Obviously, it's easy.
Yeah.
Now, if I look at the big trend, the large trend of things over time, not just failures that I had, honestly, I got so lucky in terms of everything that it would be a shame and not right to say that I would do it differently, to be frank. Because even the failures ended up into stuff that worked out. And that made me be where I am today. I'm healthy. I'm not too old yet. I have a good situation. I love my job. I do love my job. I love the team I'm working with. And so I need to do more sports probably lately. But I wouldn't do, honestly, I would not do. I mean, on a business side at least, because personally it's always different. But on a business side, I would not change things.
I love it. Thanks so much, Thomas, for sharing your story with us and telling us more about yourself and Miro and your journey. I can't wait to see you in Barcelona to hang out more. And thanks so much. And Yeah, all the best. See you soon.
See you. Bye-bye.
Ciao.